Let's turn to Genesis chapter 23, please. Genesis chapter 23. We'll do our Mother's Day class at 9 o'clock this morning. We'll be talking about Sarah, one of the most famous mothers in the Bible. Of course, we're talking about her death and burial, so that's kind of a grim way of looking at Mother's Day, but that's just how it came about, so the luck of the draw, yes, as Ray says. Although a lot of times I think it's preordained that my messages come at a certain time, sometimes for me especially. Yeah. Just by way of introduction, remember that we're talking about the life of Abraham, and now we're going to talk about the death of Sarah, his wife, and her burial. And this is a very interesting chapter, chapter 23. The lesson of this chapter is simply this. Remember, the recipients of the promises began to die before the promises are fulfilled. Now, remember, Abraham had promises of a seed, and he also had promises of a land. And that promise had not been fulfilled yet. Abraham did not own the land, and we'll see that he has to buy a burial plot for his wife, in fact. And he's living in the promised land. So we'll see that Abraham did not have his promises yet, and yet now Sarah passes away. So she passed away before the promises are being fulfilled. And the lesson is going to be this, that the promises of God go beyond this life. Don't simply think of this life when you think of the promises of God. We tend to get focused on our own lives and our own affairs and our own goings on, and we forget to take the long view. God's promises are not limited to this lifetime. And if God's promise doesn't come to fruition in this life, it will anyway. So Sarah is going to pass away, and that's the lesson of this chapter. I want to make some notes on this chapter before we start. And the first one is that Genesis 23 does not use euphemisms for death. Now, in the New Testament, when we read Paul's letters, we find that believers, what do? When they pass away? They go to sleep. And you'll see that in the New Testament. They're sleeping. Or how about those who are asleep in Thessalonians? Well, in Genesis 23, those euphemisms aren't used. It comes right out and says in verse 2, for example, Sarah died. And in verse 3, it says, then Abraham rose from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth. In verse 4, it says, I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you that I may bury my dead. So we don't see the euphemisms here that we do in the New Testament. It says it right out, Sarah has died. Now Sarah, interesting note, another interesting note on Genesis 23, is Sarah is the only woman in the Bible, in the entire Bible, whose age at her death is recorded. And it says in verse 1, now Sarah lived 127 years, and these were the years of the life of Sarah. She's the only woman in the Bible whose age is recorded. Now, by anybody's standards or by anybody's reckoning, she is one of the most important women in the Bible. Of course, Mary excluded, but she is a very, very important woman in the Bible. She is an outstanding woman, and she is uniquely important because she bore a child due directly to God's promise. And next hour, we'll look at some of the similarities between the birth of Isaac and the birth of Christ. We'll see there are a lot of them. But Sarah is uniquely important in the Bible because she bore a child directly according to God's promise. And she became the illustration then of the new birth. So when we get saved, it's the new birth. Sarah is an illustration of that because she had a child based on supernatural means. No one else in the entire Bible bore a child in the same manner or the same reason that she did. So Sarah was a very, very important person in the Bible. In fact, she is considered the mother of all believing women. Look at 1 Peter chapter 3, and we'll see that. In 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 5 and 6, it says, "For in this way, in former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children, if you do what is right, without being frightened by any fear." So he's talking about wife-husband relationships here, and he's saying, you are Sarah's children, if you act like Sarah did, as believers. So very important person. Now normally, in the time of Abraham, we're going back to Genesis 23 now, people were buried in their native land. And that's going to mean something here. The burial of Sarah in the land of Canaan shows us something. It shows us that Abraham believed the promise that God had made to him. Why do I say that? Where was Abraham's native land? Was it in Canaan? No, he didn't even have property in Canaan. He had some wells and pastures, but presumably, I would say he probably paid a rental fee for those because he didn't own any land in the land that God had given him. It's a very ironic situation here, where we have a man who is living in the land that God had given him, and he doesn't own a place to bury his wife. So he did not take her home to Ur and bury her there. He buried her in Canaan. So that's very important. It shows there was no going back for Abraham. He believed God. He said, God promised me this land. I'm going to bury my wife here, and I'm going to be buried here too. And we'll find out that he was. The major issue in this section is going to be the fulfillment of God's promises. The fulfillment of the promises. Now, chapter 23 does not make any overt theological point. There's not going to be something I can point to you and say this is the theological meaning of this chapter. Because there isn't really one point. In fact, the very fact that it's included in the Bible is really the only thing that gives us a hint that it's important. Let's do a little overview of this chapter. The overview goes like this. The chapter, that is Genesis chapter 23, is essentially a report of a death. Look at verse 1 and 2. Now Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. So we have a report of Sarah's death. Now look down at verse 10. And we'll say, now Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth, even all of who went in the gate of the city, saying, no, my lord, hear me, I give you the field. And he's talking about the field that contains the cave that Abraham wants to use to bury Sarah. What this is going to be is these two events are going to be a frame for the negotiation for the burial plot of Sarah. And that's what chapter 23 is about. The negotiation for the burial plot of Sarah. In fact, this negotiation is going to take on the feeling or the tone of a legal transaction. So Abraham is going to negotiate for a place to bury Sarah. Now, a question has to pop into your mind. Why on earth is this section included in the Bible? It's a negotiation for a burial plot. Why would God choose to record Abraham's negotiations for a burial plot for his wife? Why would it be there? And I can think of some reasons. First of all, and this is part of the biblical text or the flow of the biblical text, is that this is the first major event that happens in the transitional section of the book of Genesis. Remember, Genesis transitions. It transitions from creation, the flood, and then it goes to a nation Israel. And Abraham was the first of nation Israel. Now, here we have the first major event in that transition. Sarah dies. So that's one reason why it's recorded there. It's the first of a number of death reports that we'll have in the book of Genesis. And the writer of Hebrews summarizes these deaths in the book of Hebrews like this in 11:13. All these died in faith without receiving the promises. So all of the people that we read about in Genesis that died in the faith hadn't received the promises yet. They weren't in the promised land that God had promised to Abraham and his descendants. So we're transitioning from one section of this book to another, and what's going to happen is people are going to start dying. And how do you explain that? Well, Hebrews explains it for us. The promises of God go beyond this lifetime. The Bible is a book of history. That's the next reason I give. Why would this be recorded? Because it's a historical event. And the Bible is a book of history. People tend to forget that. They think the Bible is a religious book. The Bible is not a religious book. The Bible is a history book. And it's not mystical. It's not ethereal, anything like that. It's a book of historical facts. In fact, the man who was here before me who taught, it was one of his very pet peeves that the Dewey Decimal System has the Bible placed with religious books. It's not a religious book, it's a history book. It talks about historical events. It's a book that says this. Here's the best way to put it. God is a God who reveals himself in time and space and in history. Now that's different from a lot of religions. A lot of religions are just theological ideas. Christianity is completely different from that. It's a historical religion. Our book is a historical book, not merely a theological book. Is there theology in it? Of course. Why is that? Well, because God himself appears in time and in space, and he's part of history. So that makes it a history book, doesn't it? In fact, Francis A. Schaeffer, one of my favorite authors, probably the best philosopher of theology, calls his commentary on the book of Genesis, Genesis in Space and Time. Because Genesis is a book that took place in space and time. It's a history. So Sarah's death is a historical event. Sarah's burial is a historical event. And Abraham's negotiations for her burial plot is historical. In fact, what happens in Genesis 23 is actually confirmed, or supported at least, by Hittite history. And that's completely non-biblical. Why do I say that? Well, we'll see that Abraham, when he goes to ask for Sarah's burial plot, says there's a nice little cave here, has some trees in front of it, and we can see our homeland, Mamre, from there, or Hebron. And he says, could I buy that cave? Actually, Ephron, who's selling him the cave, says, you know what? I'm going to give you a whole field in the cave. Now, why do you suppose he did that? Well, he did it because if he were to sell that cave to Abraham and keep the field, he would be obligated under Hittite law to pay taxes on the whole thing. So he figured, well, if I'm going to get rid of this, I want to get rid of the whole thing. I don't want to pay taxes on it. So it's kind of it fits perfectly in with non-biblical historical records. Now, this is just a common sense thing. You know, sometimes we do things not for the sake of common sense, but for a tax break. And some of the things we do to get tax breaks don't make common sense. I'm sure all of you know that. That's what Ephron's going to do. The words commercial standard in verse 16, where it says, Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver, which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, commercial standard. Now that phrase, commercial standard, is a historical phrase that's used outside of the Bible. And what it means is, it was they had set a certain standard for this weight of silver will be worth this much. It's kind of similar to what we do with dollar bills. This dollar bill will be worth nothing. I mean, it'll be worth what can you get? A little hamburger at McDonald's with one now or something? They set a certain value on a certain weight of silver. And that was called a commercial standard. And this is, you can see this in the Code of Hammurabi. They had commercial standards. So when the Bible crosses paths with history, it's historically correct. So the Bible is a book of history. You know, we tend to think of it as an object of worship, and we put it on our mantelpiece and worship it, but never read it. Well, that's not what the Bible is all about. The Bible is a book we're supposed to read, and we're supposed to study, and we're supposed to understand what it means, because it's a historical book. I want to make a note here. In chapter 23 and chapter 24 that I'll do next hour, and we're going to do all of chapter 24 in next hour, and chapter 4 contains 67 verses. So we're going to speed up a little in our study of the book of Genesis. And the reason is because these sections, we'll find some of them consist mainly of genealogies. And I know it would be fun for you to sit there and listen to me stumble over these biblical names, but I'm not going to do it. I won't comment on those because they're self-evident. And there's going to be some sections that are, as we read along, there's just nothing much to say about them. They're self-evident. So I won't say a lot about those. I won't comment about those. So we'll go a little faster now. So let's do the exposition of Genesis 23 then. It starts out with the report of Sarah's death in verse 1 and 2. We read those. Now Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Now the main thing that we want to get out of these two verses is simply this, that the early recipients of the promises began to die before the promises were received. And I mentioned that before. And that's the main thing we want to get out of Sarah's death. Sarah died before Abraham took possession of the promised land. And so did every Jew since then, because they haven't taken possession of the promised land yet. So you remember in Thessalonica, the same thing happened in the New Testament. In Thessalonians, in 1 Thessalonians, Paul stayed at Thessalonica for a very short time, and he told them some prophetic things that were going to happen, and one of them was that Jesus Christ was going to return for his church. So he had to leave in a hurry, and he left. And lo and behold, what happened in Thessalonica? Some of the people started to die, didn't they? And the Thessalonians wondered, what's going to happen to these people? Are they going to be included in the rapture when the Lord returns? Are they going to go with him? What's going to happen to these people? Because the promise hadn't been fulfilled yet. Well, Paul explains it all in 2 Thessalonians. Or 1 Thessalonians, he says, don't worry about the ones who have fallen asleep, you know, because you won't go before them. They'll go before you to meet the Lord. So the same kind of a situation happens in the New Testament as well. But here in the Old Testament, here's Sarah. She died. The promises haven't been fulfilled yet. So Sarah is going to be the first of this group in the Old Testament. And the Hebrews will talk about the ones who've died in before they saw the promises. And we'll look at that in a moment. So now we're going to look at Abraham's negotiation for a place to bury Sarah. His proposal is given in verse 3 and 4. Verse 3 says, then Abraham rose from his dead, from before his dead, and spoke to the sons of Heth, saying, I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. So that's his proposal. Now note, as far as the record goes, and I've said this before, Abraham didn't own enough land to bury his wife in. He had to go buy some. He went out to negotiate for some land. In fact, as far as the record goes, the only purchase of land in the promised land that Abraham ever made was a burial plot for Sarah. And that's all he owned of the promised land his entire life, was this field with a cave in it for a burial plot. Now, presumably, remember, he had built altars, and he had that well. Remember last time when he made the non-aggression pact? He said that some of your guys have taken my well, I want it back, and they gave it back to him. Well, he owned that well not because it was on his property, but because he dug it. He was the one who dug the well. So apparently he owned that well because he dug it, and I don't want to seem grisly, but I doubt if he'd want to throw his wife down a well after she died. He owned the well because he dug the well himself, and the altars he built himself. So that's the only reason he owned them, not because they were on his property. And he had many possessions. Remember, Abraham was a very wealthy man. But with all of these possessions, he did not have a home, a certain dwelling place. He just didn't have it in the promised land. Again, remember, as Hebrews says in 11:13, that he dwelled as a stranger in his own land, the land that God had given him. I assume he paid some kind of a rent. I don't know. But he was living on someone else's land, so he probably paid rent. Maybe not. Maybe they let him live there because he was a wealthy, influential person. Now, Abraham knew where he wanted to bury Sarah. He had that already in his mind before he started all these negotiations. And what he wanted was a suitable cave with trees around it that looked on to their, what you could call their hometown of Mamre or Hebron. The oak of Mamre, remember, was in Hebron. That's where he built the altar. And that belonged to a prominent Hittite named Ephron. When we get to verse 8, where it says, "And he spoke with them, saying, if it is your wish for me to bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and approach Ephron, the son of Zohar, for me." Again, the Bible is touching history here, because it was customary in those times to ask someone else to mediate for you if you were going to make a business deal. It's like saying, have your people call my people and we'll do lunch or take a meeting. You know, that's the kind of thing that was. He had someone act as an intermediary to negotiate for him. Now that's it. In perfect accord with the exaggerated formality, and it was very, very formal to make a deal back then, in purchasing and selling especially, and that is still pretty much the way it goes on in the East as far as I understand. I'm not an expert on Eastern affairs, but as far as the commentaries and the sources I've read, that it's still very formal, it takes a long time, and so forth. The negotiations were carried out in a public assembly. In verse 7, it says, Abraham rose and bowed to the people of the land, the sons of Heth. So there was a public assembly. It was at the gate of the city. In verse 10, it says, now Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth, even all who went in at the gate of his city. Remember what the gate of the city was? It was kind of their city hall. That's where they did their transactions. And Abraham wanted to buy some land. He wanted to buy that cave for his wife. So he went down to the gate of the city to negotiate to make a deal with Ephron. Note the courtesy on Abraham's part. In verse 7, while he says, he bowed to the people of the land. And in verse 12, it says, and Abraham bowed before the people of the land. And that's part of this ceremony. It's very courteous, very formal type of thing to purchase a piece of land. The response is given in verse 5 and 6. What do the people say? Well, we can tell one thing. Abraham was held in high regard among these people. Because verse 5 and 6 says, the sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, hear us, my lord, you are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead. So Abraham was held in high regard. In fact, that phrase, Lord, you are a mighty prince among us, could also be translated, Lord, and that's the word Adonai. It's a word that's used for God. It's a word you'd use for people as well. Adonai, you are a prince of God, Elohim among us. So they held him in high regard. They considered him a prince of Elohim, the powerful one. And they offered Abraham the choicest of their graves. Now, Abraham now makes his specific proposal. He's getting down to the brass tacks now. You know how you start a deal big and then you move in. It's kind of how they do it. They take their time. They love to take their time. In fact, once I watched a documentary on King Tutankhamun, and when the head of the Metropolitan Arts Museum went to Egypt, he went to Egypt to negotiate a tour of some of the artifacts over here. He said he met the guy he was to negotiate with in a bar at night, and the guy was an hour late. It took hours and hours. They watched belly dancers, they drank, they ate, and negotiated their deal. You know, he thought it was just going to be go into his office and sign some papers, but it was anything but that. It was this big deal, very formal, very long process, and that's what Abraham's going through now to get this grave for his wife. First he says, I need a place to bury my wife. Well, he knew exactly what he wanted. He could have said, come up to Ephron and said, Ephron, I want to buy that cave you got out in the field. But it didn't happen that way. It was very elaborate. But he makes a specific proposal now. And that's in 7 through 9, when he says, so Abraham rose and bowed to the people of the land, the sons of Heth, and he spoke with them, saying, If it is your wish for me to bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and approach Ephron, the son of Zohar, for me, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns, which is at the end of his field, for the full price, let him give it to me in your presence for a burial site. So he asked now for what he wants, the cave at the end of the field. And he offered to pay the full price, no haggling. So I'll give you whatever you want for it. And Ephron was apparently the ruler of the city, because if you see in verse 10, it says at the very end, of all who went in at the gate of his city, saying. So very possibly Ephron was the head of the city, a very prominent person as well as Abraham, and he owned that land. Now the response is given in 10 and 11. And the response says, now Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth, even of all who went in at the gate of the city, his city, saying, no, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead. Now, this is part of the negotiation. He says, take it. I'll give it to you for nothing. So Ephron offers to make a present of both the field and the cave. And this is customary in the East, and what it meant was the offer was designed to get a gift in return of equal value, or to get the price set. Look at verse 15. It says, this is Ephron, my lord, listen to me, a piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver. So he gets the price out. What is that between me and you? So bury your dead. So he gets the price on the table in a kind of roundabout way. He says, I'll give you the land. What's a piece of land that's worth, you know, $4,323.48? What's that between you and me? So he gets out the price. And as a matter of fact, that was a very extravagant price for a piece of land back in those days. But he gets it on the table. So they conclude the transaction in 12 through 18, And Abraham gives the requested price. Look at verse 16. It says, Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, commercial standard. So everybody knew what was going on. Ephron said, no, take it, nothing. What's, 400 shekels between you and me? And Abraham says, well, okay, here's your 400 shekels. Okay, so they knew what was going on. It was a deal from the beginning. So Ephron states the price, Abraham pays the price, and the presence of all who are sitting at the gate, so they sealed the deal. And this whole thing was a negotiation for a burial plot for Abraham's wife. And here we find it in God's Word, in the Bible. What do we learn out of this? I mean, are we supposed to learn how to negotiate, how to make a deal with somebody? No, that's not the point. The point is, it's a historical event, and it's included in this history of the world. Now, in 19 and 20, we have the burial of Sarah. And this whole chapter, if you want to get anything out of it, theologically, it's the faith of Abraham that comes through. Because it shows us what Abraham went through, all this legal rigmarole and hassle to get a place to bury his wife. Now, it ends up, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, and Rebekah were all buried there at this same place. And Jacob buried his wife there, Leah, and Jacob requested that he be buried there. Look at Genesis 49. In Genesis 49, verse 29, it says, then he charged them and said to them, I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. And they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah there. They buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah there. And there I buried Leah in the field of the cave that is in it, purchased from the sons of Heth. When Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. So all of these people were buried in that cave. Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, Leah, and Jacob asked to be buried there as well. So that's our business law, Hittite style class for this morning. Next hour, and that's our Mother's Day class, because it talks about one of the most prominent mothers of all time. Next hour, we'll talk about Isaac's bride. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for this section in Genesis. Thank you for putting in these historical accounts that we can read so that we know that we can strengthen our faith when we see that your word, when it crosses paths with history, is absolutely historically correct. Father, we thank you for giving us this to aid in our faith, which sometimes can become weak. We pray in Christ's name, amen.